You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, Christ is risen. It is the 26th of April, 2023, and you are listening to a lecture from Matthew Raphael Johnson on the Orthodox Nationalist, which is a series, for those who don't know. I've been getting donations recently, and I've been getting donations in kind. Someone sent me a whole bunch of things for the dogs and cats, which made me laugh. And I want to thank you. I have a very generous group of people who keep me online, which is another way of saying you guys keep me independent. And the same goes for Radio Albion as a whole and anyone else who picks this up. There's going to be a new Telegram channel featuring my lectures going back to 2008, 2009, the old Orthodox Medievalist era, the Voice of Reason. Those have been uploaded to the archive page, the Internet Archive pages, and they're going to be dressed up and reissued. Of course, there are also copies of those on my newer site, theorthodoxnationalist.wordpress.com. Which is available from the Radio Albion page as well. But speaking of money, you know, last week we dealt with an extremely important topic, one of the topics that separates the modern world, and especially not just the modern world, the postmodern world. We may even, you know, go so far as to say that the modern world is one of the scientific and industrial revolution. Well, the postmodern world is that of the financial revolution. And it separates all of that from the classical and medieval eras. And it's no accident. My lectures over decades now, what side I fall, it's no mystery. And so much of what we do in writing, translating, and speaking is to teach people, at a minimum, the tools to use to analyze the world they live in. Last week, we spoke about the nature of this financial revolution, or more specifically, the concept of usury in general. The last few weeks, I actually mentioned this, I've been working on putting together a basic introduction to the political economy of oligarchy. And it serves a one very important purpose. And while I've mentioned this from time to time, I've not gone into it in any kind of detail. We wonder, outside of their ideological biases, why the great credit rating agencies are always wrong, why they predict stable economies are going to fall and unstable economies are stable. All of their, the economic disciplines, their predictions are always wrong. They've been predicting the Russian collapse and the Chinese collapse really as long as I can remember. And as soon as these governments started doing very well and trying to throw the U.S. out of their former position of global dominance, the U.S. hasn't been dominant in a very long time, the wishful thinking, the wish fulfillment, positive visualization from the regime starts. But they're always wrong. And it's very frustrating when, you know, I say something for years and years and years, and then when, you know, something big happens and it's put on front page news and everyone's talking about it like they just discovered it. The Russia-China stuff, I've been talking about since I was in my late 20s. And now you have these dopey conservative patriots talking about it like this is a brand new thing. I've said for a long time that a lot of the conservative establishmentarian types, they secretly read and listen to my stuff. They see which way the wind blows. They know that I've done all the work. And when they think they can make a dollar off it, suddenly put it out as if they created it. And the real telltale sign is that they often use my vocabulary. In that case, it can't be a coincidence. But oligarchy is not a system of government, nor is it a system of economics. It's both. It's the regime. What initially was an inchoate ruling class using crises to eventually come together to create a very coherent sense of themselves, whether it be BlackRock or just the usurious regime in general. New Khazaria. Now, I've spoken of New Khazaria for a long time. That's another fairly lengthy paper, which is mostly translations, because, you know, it's been done in Russian and Ukrainian. It hasn't been done really in English. In terms of, you know, a systematic understanding of what New Khazaria is. And when you have these, you know, prior to the war, settlers, 2006, the first installment of 500 Jews arrived on Stavropol from Israel. They lied their way to renting land. They didn't buy it, and we kind of know why, ideologically, from the Cossacks who couldn't possibly have known what they were doing, or they just needed the money. And they created what they call New Khazaria. This in Stavropol, this is near Odessa as well. And they create a separatist community surrounded by a giant wall and with armed guards trained by Mossad. This came out in the newspaper Rodina November 28th of that same year. Era Rossi. A bit after that, it's very clear they're in the process of creating a state within a state under the assumption that Israel doesn't have a future ahead of it. Being surrounded by opponents, and now with the defection of both Saudi Arabia and Turkey, which you heard on Radio Albion before any media picked it up, thanks to me, Israel is in a bad spot. But they've known this for some time. And there's not that many of them there. And New Khazaria in Ukraine, on top of the old Khazaria, this is why Crimea is so important to them, that the war, that the preemptive invasion of eastern Ukraine stopped. That wasn't the only purpose of the preemptive invasion. There were more pressing issues. But this project, at least for now, has been beaten back. This is why the regime is, one of the reasons that the regime is so obsessed with defeating Russia and just destroying their own military for the sake of supporting their private military companies and foreigners fighting in Ukraine. Most of the best infantry of Ukraine was destroyed by, you know, last summer, if not earlier. So these are, you know, these are forces from all over the world being paid for by some of these same people. People forget that prior to the war, now this is in Russia, of course, we're talking about, New Khazaria, Stavropol, is both in southern Russia as well as in near Odessa, Ukraine. So I want to be Novoalexandrovsk too. It's in the center of Stavropol. We're on the border here, and Crimea was supposed to be the core of this movement. So they're renting land, quite a bit of it, that the locals way back when this first started couldn't afford. And Mossad sent people and money to begin buying and leasing more of it. Now, of course, they don't buy anything locally. Except shares in the grain elevators and the old collective farms, which still exist. the enterprises that process grain. Of course, they're not working the land either. Stavropol, well, before the war, was the largest granary in that Russo-Ukrainian region we're talking about, amounting to about 50 million tons of grain prior to the war. It's not an accident. And I think, the Cossacks were kind of placated by saying, oh, no, this is just a lease. In the Yeltsin administration, the land law was repealed. The land law was repealed in between 2004, 2014 in Ukraine. And, of course, the banks, were mostly non-Russians, moved in very fast. And I've also mentioned that in 2012, in Peter, Petrovsk, about 120,000 square yards in size, and that's the menorah, which is the largest Jewish community center and the world's largest synagogue, was created by the Jewish oligarchs there. Now, why do I say this? It's important to say this because that's the political, social impetus. Now, Russia and Ukraine have been the center of the world for a very long time. And now with the Belt and Road Initiative, New Khazaria was supposed to be the negation of that. But none of this could happen. New Khazaria and everything it represents, you know, liberalism for everyone else, but certainly not for them. It's walls and ethnic particularism for them. Liberalism and globalization, the Great Reset, and everything that that implies, the degeneration that proceeds, and of course even more, proceeds from it. Oligarchy is the master conception. People are wrong. Establishment economists, the credit rating agencies, they're wrong because they're using older, now irrelevant variables. They still use the efficient market hypothesis, rational choice, without taking real institutions into effect. Today, economic analysis relies on old myths of the market, so-called neoclassical style. And the policy options available, both private and public, you know, they're basing these on variables and concepts and realities that no longer exist, assuming that they ever did. Even the institutions have changed over the years, and economics, and certainly not political science, has not kept up. I mean, I've seen the regime, their professional academics are just now starting to talk about oligarchy very, very hesitantly. Markets, in the sense, you know, the Adam Smith's market, is a believing that that actually still functions. That's some kind of a market idea. Oligarchs don't function in a market. They create markets. So using the market and all those assumptions as a way to analyze anything, you're going to end up sounding like an idiot. This is why they're wrong all the time. Markets, in that sense, they're purely abstract and they're hypothetical. But the master institution of oligarchy, it doesn't even distort markets. It replaces markets altogether. It doesn't function. If you mention any economic policy, such as like raising interest rates, well, the way that would function 50 years ago, and the consequences that would flow from that 50 years ago are not going to be the same that flow from it now, because none of the institutions are different. The nature of the economy is infinitely more centralized and now totally globalized. But even under the best of conditions, you know, the credit rating agencies were very politicized, and they're often laughably incorrect in how they rate credit. I mean, Russia's credit went down after all their debt was paid about 10 years ago. You know, they're told what to do. They say stupid things like Russia is an oil-dependent economy, despite the fact that less than 10% of the GDP comes from that source. Relying on official statistics from the Bureau of Labor Statistics in Washington, they either don't know that these are distortions, or they don't care. Not only the methods of how they come to their statistics, but even how it's reported later have rendered official statistics in the U.S. at best suspect, at worst totally made up. And I've said 100 times, the system has predicted the collapse of these economies. Not that, as their own as the U.S. is on the verge, the very stable economies of Russia and China, they've been predicting the collapse for a long time. And not only does it never happen, but it doesn't seem to hurt them when their predictions never come true. That's not just this is just more blatant. The economies that they're condemning by claiming it's going to collapse any moment, they're far more stable. Because oligarchies, especially in the USA, are unstable by definition. So analysis has become nothing more than psychological projection. And this isn't the first time I've mentioned psychology here. Economics is a humiliated, most of the social sciences today are humiliated disciplines. They've been humiliated because of endless bad predictions and assumptions. The 1990s in Russia, that should have destroyed economics as an institution. It almost did, actually, in terms of the Justice Department's suing Harvard University and winning. But that didn't hurt their authority, despite the fact that everything that they were saying was not just wrong, but based on corruption, because they were personally invested over there. Not to mention ideologically invested over there. So much of the information that we were given when I first started college was completely wrong, because it comes from these same sources. So you can't talk about economic policy or even analyze economic factors when you assume that this is, private property matters and that this is free market and entrepreneurship. It doesn't work that way. The state doesn't work that way. Private sector sources don't work that way. The Fed certainly doesn't work that way. And trying to find papers that are talking about how now to analyze in an era when none of the old assumptions work is extremely rare. So you have to talk about how the hypothetical world of the market differs from oligarchy, structurally speaking, and the variables that you have to take into account now that maybe you didn't have to take account of in the 50s. One of the excellent papers is Yochai Benkler. Two papers, actually, at Harvard, who has taken issue with, more or less traditional economic analysis, the way it functions, not just in academia, but in the public press, the popular press as well. In this case, even institutional economics is harmed because the oligarchy creates these institutions. It takes a while for them to catch on, but an oligarchy creates its market. It creates the institutions that matter. It justifies its own power, which essentially is what culture is. Of course, oligarchs ran Florence and Renaissance Italy, and Machiavelli himself wrote to them that if you want to convince people that somehow you have a right to rule, which we all know you don't, you have to manipulate them. You have to hide behind a smokescreen of republicanism. You have to create an ideological world that avoids inconvenient questions. Of course, then or now, those who rule us have no right to their power. It has nothing to do with their ability. Quite the contrary. They have to manipulate us in order for that, for them to even hide, let alone justify themselves. Now, Benkler is talking about the development of oligarchy from the 60s and 70s. Clearly, there's been some revolutionary shifts, let's say from the early 70s to today, that have changed the American, the global economy completely. And of course, globalization is the main one. But he identifies a few things that the oligarchy at one time, more or less decentralized and inchoate, put out in order to create a more coherent and global oligarchy with one set of policies, one set of institutions that they control, and enough media manipulation so that they can hide. And even there, the Great Reset being the ultimate expression of that, the serious criticism of it really doesn't exist. Because the leftists can't criticize their own creation. So let me quote Benkler here back in, as far as I know, it's still unpublished, but he has it on his own site at Harvard. He says social norms shifts complemented the ideological and political shifts away from solidarity, the solidaristic perceptions of self and performance, towards individualistic perceptions. The shift in the idea of the superstar exhibits this shift most clearly as over the course of the 1970s, what started out as an art world appropriation of a sports metaphor came to define a new role for corporate leadership and a new perception about relative centrality of superstar leadership to corporate performance. The transformation of norms around the superstar translated to elite cultural change through the concept of superstar salaries and winner-take-all markets. On the one hand, and the agency theory and its shareholder value theory of corporate governance and management, on the other. You've noted that the wealthy and powerful, the very wealthy, yeah, Elon Musk and everyone, but Lee Iacocca back in the 80s, these people become celebrities in their own right, which is interesting. I mean, I've seen Warren Buffett on sitcoms. That's something that has to be taken very seriously. The broader point of what he's saying, what I'm saying, is that things like the superstar CEO, a celebrity that's going to bring moral harmony to the world, like Bono, it created a false morality and a sense of moral acceptability. Now, the foundation economically is when companies started using stocks to pay high level executives. And the connection between status and money, which was never as close as it is now, created a social universe that really had no more place for markets. If image mattered and image dominated, that's not a market. You're creating a product, not a market. You're not responding to a market. You want to talk about this consumer market as rational choice, free market ideas? No. That doesn't take into account status competition. Consumers are normally irrational. They spend and spend and spend, sometimes voluntarily, sometimes involuntarily, not focused on necessities, but focused on things that make them feel better or that give them a higher status. The celebrity idea for CEOs is connected to the superstar idea, is what he's really talking about here, and it justified very high salaries in the same way that it did, or does, for ball players and actors. To the point where even the new disclosure rules permitted companies to see each other's compensation. And as these celebrity CEOs were playing one company off against another, this continued to ratchet up salaries for the same set of reasons. And he says, so that with each new round of compensation decisions, a new higher level was created for the boards making the decision to match. It's essentially celebrity worship, existing at all levels of society, that created and justified oligarchs making a huge amount of money for very little production. Celebrity worship, superstar ideology, whatever you want to call it, superstars come from, he's talking about the world of the CEO and those close to them. And the salaries seem to match media and therefore public acceptance rather than anything else. Joseph Schumpeter created a model of competition, which is worth talking about. I don't think I've ever mentioned him. And of course, he was a very early figure in saying that the hypothetical market doesn't exist, and sure as hell doesn't exist under oligarchy. Oligarchic rule invests in developing products, entire classes of products, so as to create a market that it will, of course, dominate. So an obvious example would be something like pharmaceuticals. And we'll talk about rent seeking. We talked about it last week. But for a pharmaceutical firm, the state grants a license to develop drugs, and they can extract rents, allegedly to be compensated for how long it takes to develop a drug, for 20 years. So a new drug gets a 20-year monopoly, and then after 20 years it can go generic and other companies can make it. But it also means that 20-year enforced monopoly means that the company can charge whatever it wants. You have drugs like Humira, which is going to be going generic pretty soon. An average dose is $14,000 a month. Now, what's going to happen at the end of its patent? I don't know. It's going to certainly go down. So pharmaceutical firms price their new drugs such that their profitability is far higher than other industries. A paper from the Commonwealth Fund says this. This is just one example. Talking about the pharmaceutical companies. They generally pick prices that not only cover their development costs, but also generate profits that exceed those of most other industries. For example, the average profit margin for the 25 largest software companies, which are cited as having the same high R&D investment and low production and distribution costs as pharmaceutical companies, was 13.4% in 2015, while the average profit margin for the 25 largest drug companies was 20.1% in 2015. And drug makers are also free to raise prices whenever they want at rates they alone determine. That was written in 2018. But understand that that is the opposite of a market decision. It doesn't exist. State capture, regulatory capture, allows these companies, and that's just one example. One of the marks of oligarchy, that unless you take it into consideration, you can't analyze anything, is rent seeking. I've defined that term about 100 times on this and other shows. It is a central aspect of the political economy of oligarchy. The pharmaceutical company that has a state-enforced 20-year monopoly on a new drug charges whatever it can get away with, including ridiculous amounts, pretty much whatever insurance will cover. And that's a completely different story. The difference between the market price for that and what they are charging in that 20-year period, that difference is a rent. It's their position of political power that allows them to charge money like any other monopoly would. Monopolies, oligarchies, these aren't markets. They not only don't respond to markets, they create them. I mean, look at the hype that AI is getting. These companies are seeing grant money, government and otherwise, pouring into their companies because this in and of itself has become a celebrity. AI itself, almost as a concept, has been given celebrity status. And it's not a shock that, shows and sci-fi shows are coming out that show it and to give people the impression that this is something that's going to make our lives easier. So rent-seeking is a key element here. You know, you show up at the Davos Forum or Bilderberg or anything else, you're in a position that you could pretty much do as you please. Conglomerate can charge more or less what it wants and can do what it wants because, like all of these institutions, the regime considers it, you know, themselves too big to fail. The people who regulate in the state and those who run the CEOs and their friends at the corporate level are the same people. But, you know, it's not just companies and states, but another mark of oligarchy are all manner of formal and informal networks. This is from everything from meetings at golf courses to the Davos Forum. And people, what was the point of trilateralism? What was the point of Bilderberg? It's to coordinate action along multiple fronts, whether it be finance, media, education, foreign policy, anything like that. Oligarchs profit from rents both in the technology itself, but that also has to be rationalized, and that happens by control over public ideology and public institutions. But of course, at least for now, they require policy coordination at all levels. This has to happen. Any profit, I mean, of course, this policy coordination means giant profits, almost guaranteed profits for them. That would fall under a rent. It wouldn't even technically be a profit, because profit implies a market connection. These aren't markets. This is a matter of power that is neither political nor economic. At a minimum, it's both, But of course, it's a brand new form of power. Again, I've termed it the regime, new Kazadia. Liberal democracy is inherently oligarchic, and they imply one another. In other words, liberalism is crafted, imposed, and enforced by those who benefit from it. And that refers to those who have the power to bankroll candidates and centralize, you know, in simple politics, like, you know, politicians are not the only political actors, and centralize what they pretend is independent media. Liberal democracy requires mountains of money for anyone to run for office. And if the media doesn't recognize you, you don't exist. These are tightly centralized institutions. Now, as I say about everything, the scholarship on this is a disaster. And the last 10 years, it's very rare. It's increasingly common to see the word oligarchy or plutocracy, but it was very rare even 10 years ago. So what I've seen, it's presented in one of three ways. And this is very general. A, something that only foreign governments have. B, that it's actually a form of government rather than the connection of economic and political actors. Or C, something that liberalism, believe it or not, could cure. And I think the worst, just simply stupid example comes from Stanford. They had an entire symposium, 2018, and it had this title. This is the actual title. I'm not making this up to be funny. Building Oligarchy. Are there links between economic and political inequality in the United States? This is what Stanford University is asking. But, you know, that level of understanding, to ask a stupid question like that, this is typical of the academic establishment. And it continues to believe it lives in a very different era than it actually does. They refuse to understand oligarchy and what it really is. And it gets worse. In the introduction to this thing, it says, with notable exceptions, most political scientists have argued that there isn't any empirical evidence for such a tight linkage between economics and politics. And this is why that imbecility is why stuff like this has to be done. Why those of us outside of the mainstream have to do what we do. Critical thinking, even basic critical thinking, is gone. The stupid statements can exist and can continue to have some kind of acceptance because the variables that they're talking about don't exist. They talk about abstractions, not realities. The Great Reset world, which is now different from the New World Order, it's the next stage, doesn't exist yet. I've briefly suggested it, but it doesn't exist. But this has everything to do with this connection between economics and politics, which is too obvious to be discussed. So what else are we talking about here? Any money that flows to an organization because of laws that they're able to pass or take advantage of, that's also a rent. If the route to success isn't to respond to a market, but rather to socialize costs and privatize profits, then that has nothing to do with markets either. That is entirely rent-seeking. Things like the right to work, where you don't have to join a union, which help destroy unions, or even the World Trade Organization. These are institutions, part of an institutional structure that has liberated corporate capital from any real countervailing power, and for the most part, the strictures are totally unknown to the broader public. The ultimate rent-seeking scam is globalization. Because in this sense, rent extracting is now global in scope and way beyond regulation, even if it could be effectively regulated. I did a paper back in the early 2000s, if not earlier, when Microsoft emerged victorious in their monopoly case, restraint of trade case. It was a long time before the Justice Department would take on another firm like that again. Microsoft was and is just more powerful than government. This is what makes people like Bernie Sanders so ridiculous. Who exactly is going to regulate banks? They couldn't function for 5 minutes without money being forwarded from the banks. And in Microsoft, it makes me laugh. Any market any government action usually uses Microsoft software. That is beyond rent. That's beyond even expropriation. Apple charges what it does because it's the alternative, the other option to Microsoft, to avoid standard software that's usable across multiple platforms. That increases the expropriation of rents tremendously, or at least horizontally. The ideological institutionalization that shows itself in legal forms, media forms, this is essential to economics because it has everything to do with charging rents. Remember the Christmas used to have a big toy every year. I remember Tickle Me Elmo from, 94? Where'd that come from? It was being sold for $1,000 each. And back then, every year had something new. It doesn't quite exist much anymore. But I've seen it more recently. That manipulation of media to create this artificial furor, clamor, is a huge part of modern economics. It has nothing to do with markets. And yet, when people analyze these relationships, they use abstract market thinking, which doesn't make any sense. Now, there are many authors. Farohar, Davis in 2009. Oligarchy also harms the productivity of labor because there's a close connection between the development of oligarchy and the rule of finance. In other words, when the economy moves away from the modern concern with the production of things to living off of derivatives of things. And now, actually, derivatives aren't even a thing. It's like gold, mostly being pieces of paper rather than actual gold. Don't you dare ask for gold. The Germans tried it and got nothing. There is no gold, at least as far as the West is concerned. Labor productivity is going to drop when the majority of a company's profit is coming from finance, coming from usury. The more finance takes over an economy, the less money now is available for actual production. Money is diverted away from it. Another mark of oligarchy is when actual performance, whether it be the CEO of anyone else, takes a back seat to asset stripping. Of course, there, the stress always is and has to be on short-term stock prices or short-term profit in general. And globalization is a huge part of this decline. And it's led to a huge drop in investment in workers. A long-term form of thinking is to build careers, not jobs, not gigs, like the Great Reset says, but a educated, stable, and skilled base of labor. They fell by the wayside because such investments were based on high short-term costs but long-term payoffs. That's not how the postmodern economy functions. When a stock price goes up, especially if it goes up over nothing productive, and stock prices have nothing to do with actual production, that's one of the reasons that CEO salaries go through the roof. Someone like Warren Buffett is praised in major media. He's a celebrity in his own right. But very few people, occasionally some phony leftist will ask the question and then forget about it. We'll get to that in a minute. But what right does he have to control that level of money anyway? There's nothing special about that man. And he's often wrong in his own forecasts. But the end of all this, the terminus of all this, as far as we're concerned now, is the Great Reset. And the Great Reset is represented by the dominance of BlackRock and, to a lesser extent, Vanguard. There is a connection between the rise of the financial sector, even among the productive economies, because they all have, financial subsidiaries. There's a connection between the financial sector rise and the maintenance of oligarchy. Because really, oligarchs function, like with rent and usury, this is all non-productive work, or not work at all. Derivatives and instruments like that, they're not real, but they have a real effect. And the real effect is actually taking money from people who can actually use it. It's debt to create more debt. Of course, it's short term. It creates a bubble. But if you were in that position, you wouldn't have a problem with it. I mean, assuming you were a sociopath, because you're going to be bailed out. It doesn't matter anyway. There's only a handful of you, and you all know each other. The short term matters. If you're going to manipulate the public ideologically, all you have is the short term, because they can't think in the long term. The short term dominates, so finance and the short term mentality is a part of the oligarchic rule. And through these ideologies, the institution increases the domination of these celebrity CEOs and general celebrity worship in general, which justifies these high salaries, whether it be in cash or stock. But back in the 80s, you know, I've spoken of and complained about the president as a celebrity, a president as somebody who has this mystic mission, rather than just being the chief policeman and the chairman of the cabinet, which is really all the president is. It wasn't even a full-time job. If anything, it was a military position, you know, if you're George Washington or Andrew Jackson, but that's not even meant to be that. The president's become almost a mystic figure. He's seen as the ultimate monarch. Of course, it's not how it ever was understood until fairly recently. Well, the same thing goes for the CEO. In the 80s, the concept of the CEO changed pretty radically, and it mirrored the way that the American presidency had been changed, or any chief executive, really. The very word executive meant that you were successful when I was a kid. So it changed to something like the ideal CEO as someone who is a visionary leader, someone who is good on camera, rather than someone with actual functional knowledge. And it altered the significance of the CEO and those like him, because, of course, it affected their salary. They were embodying something, a leadership style, a celebrity in their own right, rather than a necessary and very important body of knowledge. This is all competitive bidding in that market, under skewed perceptions, essentially media perceptions, and skewed perceptions of the value of a CEO, almost as a celebrity too, and they had this massive explosion in compensation under the early Reagan years. Now, the context really was a leveraged buyout phenomenon, but it doesn't matter. It all comes to the same end. It's not ridiculous to connect a word like financialization to oligarchy. Financialization is an ideological shift, but it's also a shift in how an economy can function. Financialization is a process where an increasing share of financial rather than productive instruments in a company's or an economy's profit. In other words, the source of profit used to be based on producing things, growing things. It is not anymore. A huge proportion and a growing proportion of profit comes from interest rate related instruments. The increasing share of total profits that financial instruments produce, whether indirectly or directly, becomes noticeable, and then companies will divert resources into those instruments. Let me quote Benkler again, 2017. He says, between 1950 and 2001, employment in the financial service real estate sectors, FIRE, financial, insurance, and real estate sectors grew from about 4% of all employment to about 7%. And that same sector doubled its share of GDP from 12 to 24% and quadrupled its share of corporate profits from about 11 to almost half. At the same time, the share of portfolio income, that is interest, dividends, capital gains, of non-financial firms relative to cash flow, profits plus depreciation, increased from about 7 or 8% throughout the 50s and 60s to about 50% by 2001, and in manufacturing firms in particular, reached nearly 100%. And no one actually, you know, debates these. Media perception, Wall Street became the pinnacle of success, ideologically speaking. It's been romanticized in movies like The Wolf of Wall Street, which I strongly recommend, by the way. There's no question that this has happened. But there aren't enough people who know how to question it rationally. But even in the late 80s, you know, high interest rates returned. About 80% of a company, you know, the major, the blue chips, non-financial, in other words, they're not a bank or anything like that, 80% of their holdings came from usury. So even actual productive enterprises were only making 15% of their money from production. or put more accurately, of a non-financial company's holdings, 80% comes from usury. Maybe 15% come from production. Maybe. It's not as high. There's another 5% in there, kind of an other, but I don't know if that's robbery or what, but. And then you had a rise again in the middle of the 1990s. It's become worse overall. Now financial instruments have come to dominate almost entirely. And you could actually have GDP growth based entirely on this. It's not growth. It's out of nothing. This means what counts as actual growth is not growth at all. So however you want to measure it, the sectors that are labor intensive, you know, manufacturing, obviously, accounted for a much smaller proportion of economic growth than before. But it didn't just come from, you know, there's nothing natural here. This is forcibly done, ideologically, even legally, as an aspect of globalization. And in the midst of this is oligarchy. This can't function. This is in no one's interest but the regime's. Therefore, it has to be run by a small, highly coherent group that meets, that knows each other, and that's able to manipulate the media that they also control. So anyone focusing on financial returns, is inherently encouraged to move away from long-term production. Everything is then short-term. Everything's based on interest rates. So when you talk about the infrastructure for production, you're not just talking about the physical aspect. You're talking about employee retention. You're talking about employee training, the building of careers, experts in production, which is something that CEOs know zero about. I mean, manufacturing, agriculture requires an entire infrastructural system that can support it. But over time, when finance dominates, this structure disappears. I said it before, but you know, when Trump was talking about bringing manufacturing back to America, I said, well, that's wonderful, but that's going to take a very long time because the infrastructure mentally and physically doesn't exist for that. Now it's gotten worse because the Great Reset has normalized the idea of the gig economy, which is an actual thing now. These aren't even jobs anymore. It's piecework. I mean, the globalization tried to say that third world labor is going to be cheaper. And it may have a slight impact on productivity. It doesn't matter because the short-term savings of something like that are tremendous. And stockholders notice this kind of thing. They're demanding short-term gains. That's why they invest. Investing is a game. It's a gamble. It has nothing to do with actual knowledge of a firm. But by the early 80s, you had high inflation from the late 70s and interest rate hikes. And that created a huge stress. Bank deposits. And that's where the negotiable CD came from, or the money market fund, way back when. Because they circumvented the regulatory limits on the interest. Once elites started doing this, the financial press noticed it, and then offered this over time to this new market. Ordinary people now can profit from it. And people forget about this. By 1979, 1980, you had liberal consumer advocacy organizations demanding banking deregulation. Because they sought higher returns on savings. It was the late 70s where you saw a massive growth in the number of companies that had lobbyists permanently in D.C. And the business PAC, Political Action Committee, it's then that it came to its own. Lobbyists went up 400% just in a few years. The oligarchy began to realize itself. It was developing rapidly, and it needed to take over the legislative apparatus to maintain itself. Laws had to eventually be drawn up by them. Law and control over law is a huge part of rent extraction. But to a great extent, it's a consequence of globalization and financialization, not necessarily the cause. But it has elements on both sides. Remember what the left did. There was a time where this left-right distinction certainly didn't exist the way it does now. There was a claim that the left had a, as honest as they can get, the love for the working man and the union. But where big money went was to the Frankfurt School and those like them, So identity politics ended up taking over from any concern with the working class, which is overwhelmingly white, especially back then. This is one of the things that rationalized the growth in elite wealth. Identity politics became dominant in leftist circles in the 1980s. This is why the left turned their backs on the millions of white and male blue-collar workers who were laid off in the 70s and the early 80s, without a peep from anyone who wanted to protect the lower classes. The left stopped talking about unions. Maybe the left never really cared. But the regime offered them power. I mean, actually, the left essentially is the regime. But they had to shift their focus away from unionization. Yet the globalization that helped create all this and caused all this came from these new structures. Things like, you know, insurance for overseas investment and other subsidies provided by the state. Because the working class was mostly white and male, you know, especially the blue collar, they were ignored as they lost jobs by the millions. The left deliberately ignored them. The left is not just a creation of the oligarchy, it is the oligarchy. There was a series of studies in the 1990s that, you know, stated what we kind of already knew, that unionized male workers with solid earnings lost massively from deregulation. That's the Hearst paper from 1988. That's actually, you know, late 80s, early 90s. It's just one sector. It was the left that demanded deregulation in the late 70s. And they skew the argument now, acting like this was Reagan's idea, this was a so-called right-wing idea, as if the right wing could ever have anything to do with these kind of policies. It was Ted Kennedy and Ralph Nader that demanded the separation of the state from big business because they claimed that agencies themselves would be staffed by industry members. Now, they're right. They were right then. They're right now. But that's why they demanded deregulation. It wasn't the Reaganites. So as the Reagan era began, those high rates, as I mentioned, began to draw new sources of capital. So it forced companies outside of the financial sector to pursue what we kind of call generally junk bonds, very high yield but very risky. And part of the mentality was to compensate now for high interest rates and hence high, you know, high borrowing costs. But it also meant that profits for non-financial firms, we're not talking about banks or savings and loans, that came increasingly from their newly minted financial sector, their own subsidiaries, which mirrored the economy as a whole. When inflation goes up, you know, given the conditions of the early 80s, not now, but inflation in that era shifted investment from actual production to non-productive, usury-based economy, the financial world, that, of course, this day uses debt to finance more debt. And people think that actually refers to something. It's not an accident that the era we're talking about now is also the start of mass globalization. They put the pedal to the metal here, where the U.S. or so-called American firms sought out compliant, cheap labor markets, hollowing out the industrial base of the U.S., along with its best blue-collar workers. In the 70s, early 80s, blue-collar workers were associated with Archie Bunker. How can you possibly support a guy like him? To this day, the blue collar is as close to National Socialism as you're ever going to get. But what happens when this trend continues? It creates bubbles. A bubble is a delusion. It's the creation of immense value that doesn't exist. It has real effects, but it's not an actual cause. And it affected stocks, too, bringing these absurd returns based on nothing. It was pure overvaluation. I've gone through that 1,000 times. But that also helped create the celebrities, the huge salaries of oligarchs, and permitted it either to become a celebrity in their own right or to hide from public view. And as always, the obvious shift to short-term means of quick profit. But a part of that was the destruction of the concept of a career and the replacement with jobs. Jobs and careers, as you know, are two very different things. that even jobs were gone by the Great Reset. And what wasn't shifted abroad is now going to be reducible to piecework. You can do something for somebody for a month, for a week, and keep, you know, moving to different places. No benefits, no money. That means that who is the ultimate target of oligarchy other than me and you? It's the middle class. Skilled blue-collar labor. The process introduced the American economy and the average person to the irrational volatility and the radical insecurity of finance. They've consistently driven economies into oligarchy and from oligarchy in these crazy boom-bust cycles. And, of course, bailouts. And there is nothing that marks off an oligarchy more obnoxiously than bailouts. Bailouts are clear evidence that the hypothetical free market doesn't function. Neither does private property. The crashes like savings and loan crisis in the late 80s, which I vaguely remember. The Asian crash in 1997. The dot-com bubble, 2000, 2001. And, of course, 2008. And COVID. All one and the same. The economy was in depression status anyway. This just destroyed what was left of small business and the middle class. The Asian market crash of 97, I was in grad school for that. I spent a lot of time on it. And one of the things it did for those countries that didn't have a state-run central bank, so it didn't affect Taiwan and China, but it also allowed American globalized firms to buy up firms in Japan and South Korea. And some of you may remember they used to have a lifelong employment idea that employees were practically guaranteed jobs for 30, 35 years. They had company stores and company schools and everything else. It became a kind of a family life. And when the Americans, with some of their local dependents, started buying up these companies, they destroyed that. And a lot of that is now long gone. And no one really talks about it much anymore. The mortgage meltdown, which I've gone on and on about, 2008, which no one has ever recovered from, was directly linked to these immensely complex financial products that were introduced in the 1980s. But it all comes down to rent extraction. Remember, money doesn't disappear. It just changes hands. There was never any recovery from 2008. Despite all the myths that are promoted by major media, selectively using statistics that are iffy anyway. And I don't have to tell you about what COVID did to the economy. And now the obsessive drive to destroy Russia and China. And the regime doesn't care if millions die. In fact, they're all in favor of population control anyway. But they're going to lose. And the bailouts in 2020, as I said at the time, were run by BlackRock. BlackRock was the actor that connected both the Fed and the state, you know, the Fed and Treasury, two very different institutions, to the oligarchs more broadly. And they channeled the bailout money. Of course, the rise of oligarchy and how it functions, there are many factors here, none of which had anything to do with free markets in the normal sense. I don't want to stress too much, you know, lobbying and the PAC. That's important. It was important when it came to the selective deregulation of the banking industry. It depended also on the intellectual dominance of liberalism, broadly speaking. And part of that came from the late 70s leftist skepticism about regulation. They were right, but just for all the wrong reason. Tight centralization of popular culture. There's not a huge difference between political reporting, foreign policy reporting, and the entertainment industry. It's the same companies anyway. But as I said, they tied status to money more closely than any other time. not aristocratic status or anything else. There are no aristocrats. These are oligarchs. The perceptions of the superstars or the celebrities. And as actors and sports figures were getting obscene amounts of money, at least in public, I don't know what their salaries really are, but at least the public ones, that drove up celebrities in specific fields. Not just the big celebrities in music and acting, whatever it is. Music, so to speak. I mean, AI does the music, but they're just, you know, they look a certain way. But technology itself, you know, introduced a new dynamism. And believe it or not, it didn't increase productivity, it reduced it. It seems counterintuitive because an oligarchy is going to use technology differently than if this were actually a market, basically free market, agricultural and industrial mid-level type of economy, you know, small, medium business for most things. This is just raw power. Rent extraction implies raw power. And this is all created by those who are in a position to take advantage of it. They create their own markets. They create the products and culturally create the hype that guarantees that they're going to be taken seriously. So these kind of dynamics, the political shifts, organizational changes, put them in a position to take the massive, overwhelming majority of the gains from their own financialization, something that they themselves put into motion. Well, I only got halfway through. Consider this part one. I'm going to do part two next week. And on the political economy of oligarchy. And we'll talk a bit more about New Khazaria as well. I'm over my limit. So I say, as always, thank you, my friend, for listening. And I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.